Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on the Supreme Court's Three Cheers for Free Speech. Our speaker today is Anya Bidwell. Anya leads the Institute for Justice's Project on Immunity and Accountability. Through this project, Anya works to promote judicial engagement and ensure that government officials are held to account when they violate individuals' constitutional rights. Anya also serves as an advisor on the American Law Institute's Restatement of the Law Constitutional Torts Project. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker, her full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives her presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to get to as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Anya, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Hi, Caroline. Thank you for having me. Thank you to the Federalist Society for putting together this event. I know that nothing else is happening in the country right now. So it's a nice and quiet time to be discussing under-radar Supreme Court opinions and summary reversals. So I really appreciate you guys being here. In all seriousness, I really wanted to participate in this event because I think that local retaliatory arrests are a big civil rights issue of our time. And the Supreme Court in the last year perceptibly shifted on this. But again, we hardly ever hear about this topic. These arrests happen in small towns. They fly under radar of the national press. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they will scrutinize every move by Bill Barr or Mary Garland. But when it comes to an old lady being thrown in jail by a police chief for opposing his policies, you'd be surprised, but old ladies are the ones who tend to be brave enough to be a thorn in the thigh of local thugs. These news organizations, they are really not as interested. And local retaliatory arrests are much more common than many of us think. For example, we at the Institute for Justice evaluate 2 to 3 potential cases every couple of weeks involving some mayor or police chief using the power of arrest as means of silencing critics. And often when we look under the rug, we find out that that's not the first time this mayor or this police chief did this. One of the cases I will be discussing today, Gonzalez versus Trevino, involves the town of Castle Hills, Texas. Our client, Ms. Gonzalez, was one of many residents imperiled by retaliatory law enforcement. When I was investigating the case, I personally spoke with many more Castle Hills residents subjected to deplorable treatment in punishment for their opposition to local policies. Only Ms. Gonzalez was brave enough to file a lawsuit, but we hope that her example, the Supreme Court victory, and also these two additional examples that I will be talking about today, will encourage others in their communities to stand up to the powers that be. And if they are wrongly arrested, or if they are wrongly subjected to other law enforcement intimidation practices, that they file lawsuits, because with these three cheers for free speech, it actually has become easier for plaintiffs and their lawyers to bring these kinds of cases to federal court. Again, Castle Hills, Texas, is not an outlier. Just in this last year, we ran into cases in Escambia County, Alabama, where a newspaper publisher and reporter were arrested for publishing a story based on their confidential sources on a school superintendent misusing COVID-19 funds. And she, the publisher, who is again an elderly lady, was thrown in jail. In Surfside, Florida, a teenage activist, a 17-year-old kid, spent 27 hours in jail for allegedly pushing the vice mayor during a debate. The original affidavit relied on the vice mayor's account, but later interviews revealed that the confrontation actually never took place. But again, the kid was thrown in jail and spent 3 days waiting to be released. In Trumbull County, Ohio, a local politician spent a day in jail after she criticized the sheriff for abominable jail conditions. And in Marion County, one of the few examples that actually got national coverage, a newspaper officer's and the owner's home were raided. And a councilwoman's home, again, an elderly lady, was also raided after the newspaper and the council member investigated the police chief and the mayor. So some of this abominable behavior is related to the drying up of the independent local media. Newspapers and news stations that are left don't have the resources and, frankly, stamina to oppose powers that be. Imagine if you are a local correspondent in Castle Hills and you want to report on Mayor Tirinho. You essentially have no future in that area. So it's really not incentivized to go out and cover this kind of stuff. So it flies under radar. And some of this is really related to tough legal barriers that prevent lawyers from taking on these kinds of cases in the first place. So one of these barriers that made it really difficult for plaintiffs to sue and for lawyers to frankly be interested in bringing these kinds of lawsuits is the so-called probable cause bar to retaliatory arrest suits. For some years now, before the Gonzalez decision came out, there's been this general understanding that if a critic was arrested for a crime that at the time of the arrest was supported by probable cause, he can't turn around and argue that he was arrested because of his criticism and not because there was a reason to believe that he violated some law. So that really allowed local politicians to launder their First Amendment violations through probable cause. As you all know, criminal codes in this country are extremely expensive. So expensive, in fact, that in Justice Gorsuch's words, almost anyone can be arrested for something on a daily basis. Another stat that Gorsuch uses in his overruled book that I highly recommend that just came out is that 70% of Americans have committed an imprisonable offense at some point in their lives. And that's a very conservative estimate. So there really always is a pretext to arrest a critic. And then you can say there was probable cause and you can prevent any kind of litigation. The prototypical example of this that's been used in every single case, essentially, that's been on this issue at the Supreme Court is jaywalker. So let's say I jaywalked and there was a probable cause to arrest me for that. But I also happen to be a critic of the mayor who ordered the police to arrest me. Should I be able to sue, or does probable cause prevent me from doing so? So that's the question that was at issue in the Gonzalez versus Trevino case that I argued at the Supreme Court in March. And that was also the question in the other two cases that I want to tell you about, Murphy versus Schmidt, which is another one of IJ cases, that we filed soon after we argued Gonzalez. And that was also partially an issue in Villarreal versus Alanis, a case that was litigated by FIRE. The petition there was also filed after we argued Gonzalez. This court really decided these three cases in less than 4 months. It decided them correctly from the point of view of First Amendment advocates by reversing all three lower court rulings, immunizing government officials for arresting and jailing their critics and laundering those activities through finding probable cause. Together, these three decisions send a clear message to those seeking to use the power of their government offices to punish criticism. Don't do it. And if you do it, be prepared to defend your actions in court. So let me briefly tell you about each one of these cases. I think if you're on this call, you probably know about all three of them. But really, what's amazing is that the only thing these cases have in common in terms of facts was that in each of them, there was probable cause to arrest the plaintiff, who also happened to be a critic. But other than that, the facts are extremely different. Now the Supreme Court said that probable cause is not an absolute barrier in any of them. So following these 4 months of decisions, all three cases can now go back to lower courts and plaintiffs can proceed with their claims. So Gonzalez versus Trevino is the first case, and it was decided on June 20th. It did most of the court's talking. The case involved then newly elected 72-year-old city councilwoman, Sylvia Gonzalez, whose first and last challenge to the establishment, because she soon quit being on the city council, was organizing a petition calling for the removal of the city manager. During the meeting where the petition was presented, Ms. Gonzalez put what she thought to be a copy of the petition in her binder. When the mayor mentioned that this was the original, she gave it back. As Judge Oldham said in his dissent in the Fifth Circuit, you'd think that would be the end of the matter, but it really wasn't. 2 months later, Ms. Gonzalez, to her shock, was handed a warrant for her arrest and thrown behind bars. She then found out that her offense was tampering with the government record because she put what she thought was a copy of her petition that she presented or she championed in the binder. The charges were very quickly dismissed, and Ms. Gonzalez sued for the violation of her right to criticize the city manager. And mind you, the charges were dismissed by the district attorney, who was circumvented in this entire process because defendants knew that if they were to get him involved, he would never allow them to bring these charges. So Sylvia Gonzalez sued and she was stopped in her tracks by the Fifth Circuit. She actually prevailed in the district court. And the Fifth Circuit held that government officials are generally immune from accountability for arresting their critics on pretextual charges supported by probable cause. That was something that the Supreme Court, fortunately for Ms. Gonzalez and other plaintiffs like her, disagreed with. In June, it reversed the Fifth Circuit. The court explained that First Amendment violations cannot be so easily laundered through probable cause. When a plaintiff can show, as Ms. Gonzalez did, that her arrest was unusual and she presented objective evidence, she alleged objective evidence to show that, then it indicates that the arrest might be pretextual and entitles the plaintiff to her day in court. So defendants can't just find probable cause, arrest a critic, and then think that they're immunized, which is something that a lot of courts really thought was the case following the Supreme Court's ruling in Nieves versus Bartlett. So that was really good news when the court in Gonzalez said, no, we really don't mean for this to be an absolute bar. If plaintiff can present or allege evidence that goes beyond allegations of state of mind, like, for example, Sylvia can't just say, Ms. Gonzalez can't just say, listen, the mayor did not like me. He looked at me funny, right? That's my evidence why I think he retaliated against me. But no, when Ms. Gonzalez can actually show that, look, the district attorney was circumvented in this entire process. I am an elderly woman, and this is an overcrowded jail, and I don't have a criminal record. Why am I being put in jail? Oh, and by the way, look at all these records in Bexar County. Nobody like me was ever arrested on these types of charges. So this kind of evidence is objective evidence of pretext, and simply because there's probable cause, courts should not be blinding themselves to clear evidence of retaliation. So that was Gonzalez versus Trevino, and that was the first indication from the Supreme Court that retaliatory arrests are going to be taken seriously. The court then doubled down on Gonzalez versus Trevino. On its first day back from summer recess, the court, citing Gonzalez, revived another retaliatory arrest lawsuit in Murphy versus Schmidt. The first order of the early in the term. So that was very exciting. The court summarily reversed the Eighth Circuit decision that was very similar to the Fifth Circuit's decision in Gonzalez. That Eighth Circuit decision immunized a police officer who jailed a man named Mason Murphy for talking back to a police officer. Mason was minding his business, walking on the side of a rural road in Missouri. Then this police officer stopped him and asked him to identify himself. Mason said, I did not do anything wrong. I was not committing any crime. I was behaving well, very peacefully. So you can't really ask me to identify myself. And after 9 minutes of back and forth, the police officer, really annoyed by Mason talking back, took him to a police station. And there is a body cam footage that shows the officer really didn't arrest Murphy because Murphy was walking on a rural side of the road, but he arrested him for arguing with him. That body cam footage shows, for example, the officer complaining that Mason, quote, ran his mouth off. And the officer even asked a colleague to help him think of a charge. The body cam footage shows the officer asking the other officer, what can I give him? And the other officer responded, I don't know. This is going to be a tricky one. So they really didn't find anything on Mason. They released him after Mason spent several hours in jail. And then only after Mason filed the lawsuit, they said, oh, we looked into Missouri statutes, and it turns out it's a crime to be walking with traffic on a Missouri road. Against traffic is a proper way, in case you guys are wondering. But if you're going with traffic, then you can be arrested for it. And so Mason sued. And again, he said, listen, nobody gets arrested for walking on the wrong side of the road. It's like a quintessential jaywalking exception that I discussed earlier. But despite this evidence of pretext, including the body cam footage, the Eighth Circuit, like the Fifth Circuit, throughout the case for probable but clearly pretextual cause. Again, the Supreme Court reversed, and it reversed by citing to Gonzalez. It really didn't explain its reasoning. It just said that the Eighth Circuit's opinion is vacated and the case is remanded back to the Eighth Circuit to reconsider. And for those listening, I highly recommend Judge Grutt's dissent in Murphy versus Schmidt, where he was proven to be right and was vindicated in his analysis of how these kinds of cases should proceed. So we have the Fifth Circuit reversed in Gonzalez, and then 4 months later, we have the Eighth Circuit reversed in Murphy. And by the way, the Supreme Court still wasn't done. The next week following Murphy, the court revived yet another retaliatory arrest case in light of Gonzalez. In this third case, Villarreal versus Alaniz, the Fifth Circuit immunized Laredo police for jailing a citizen journalist, whose arrest was a culmination of a long-running dispute over her reporting on local issues. The officers arrested Villarreal after she used her source inside the government to report on a story. And they used a statute. They found probable cause in a statute in Texas that made it a crime to ask government official questions with intent to obtain a benefit. So that statute is not enforced. Because if that statute were enforced, you'd see journalists arrested on a daily basis, because that's what journalists do. They ask people questions with intent to obtain benefit, because they get subscriber money. The New York Times gets subscriptions, and the New York Times reporter is going to ask that source a question. And according to that statute, there is probable cause to arrest that New York Times reporter. So the court didn't care, though. The Fifth Circuit didn't care, because there was probable cause based on that statute for a clearly pretextual crime. The Fifth Circuit said that Villarreal couldn't sue. And again, the Supreme Court reversed and ordered the Fifth Circuit to rethink things in light of Gonzalez. Interestingly, in Villarreal, the fire did not petition on the retaliation question. They petitioned on two extremely important questions, whether it obviously violates the First Amendment to arrest somebody for asking government official questions and publishing the information they volunteer. I'd say yes. And also whether qualified immunity is unavailable to public officials who use a state statute in a way that obviously violates the First Amendment. Those were two questions presented. But the fire did include a footnote in their petition where they said, depending on what the court decides in Gonzalez, it should at the very least GVR the Villarreal case in light of Gonzalez. And that's exactly what the court did. The court issued a summary reversal, again saying that the case should be reconsidered in light of Gonzalez, and vacating the clearly erroneous Fifth Circuit ruling. Again, the facts of these cases cannot be more different. We have a citizen journalist, we have a council member, and we have a kid minding his own business walking on the side of the road. They really involve very different factual situations, but there is one thing in common. The government officials, in the words of then Attorney General Robert Jackson, picked the men and then searched the law books. But as of October 15th, in the span of June 20th to October 15th, they all now have another thing in common. It's that the Supreme Court said that we don't do that sort of thing in the United States of America. And when you file a lawsuit and you allege evidence that shows that the arrest is unusual and the probable cause is clearly pretextual, then you should be able to proceed with your lawsuit. So the hope here, and why I'm so grateful for FedSoc for hosting me, is that the government officials get the word that they no longer can launder their violations through probable cause, and that they need to find another way to engage with their critics rather than throwing them in jail and trying to intimidate them so they don't criticize them in the future. So I mentioned these cases earlier in my talk that happened just in the last year. The Escambia County case, the Marion County case, the Surfside, Florida case, the Trumbull County case. Really, given what the Supreme Court did in these 4 months by clarifying what the probable cause bar means and when it applies in Gonzalez versus Trevino, and then by summarily reversing these other two cases involving government critics, that all these cases that I mentioned, if they're not filed yet, should be filed. And when they are filed, I'm hoping that the district courts and the circuit courts will be much more careful about how they're looking at these kinds of cases, that they don't just grant a motion to dismiss merely because there's probable cause, that they look at the evidence behind these arrests and allow critics to move forward with their cases. And that's it.
Great. Thank you so much. That was so helpful. So first question from our audience, and just a reminder to people that you can submit questions through our audience Q&A feature. So someone says, might these precedents help President Trump if he eventually sues Biden or Garland or Bragg or Willis, alleging pretextual prosecution to punish him for his criticism of the administration?
Yeah, that's a good question because the arguments are related. I kind of emphasize that this is especially important in the context of local retaliation and really Section 1983 lawsuits. And Section 1983 lawsuits are filed against state officials and local officials. And I think there is unquestionably an argument that can be made in other contexts as well, but it's particularly relevant in context of mayors and police officers using their powers of arrest running their small cities like authoritarian kingdoms. But you're absolutely right that this kind of this kind of framework applies in broader context as well. And that's something that I think is important to emphasize. It doesn't matter which speech we're talking about here, right? Conservative speech, liberal speech, I don't know, some completely unrelated speech to either sides of the ideological spectrum. The point is that the government should find another way to engage with the critics rather than use the power of law enforcement. And the court is very clear about this. So that's really good news for those kinds of claims.
Helpful. So another question someone wants to know is about the increased prevalence of body cams and curiosity about, is this going to result in less litigation moving forward because, you know, there's more video evidence out there, which might make police behave a certain way. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, the body cam aspect of this is really interesting. I think it's great to have body cams because they provide us with so much more information. And like in cases of First Amendment retaliation, it kind of can go either way, right? If there is a body cam footage of a police officer arresting an unruly protester, then the Supreme Court made it clear that that kind of body cam footage is not really going to be very persuasive because it's very much like in the heat of the moment, the officer is trying to communicate clearly with somebody he perceives to be dangerous to himself and to the bystanders. And even if he says something in that moment that might sound like he's trying to shut up this person because he doesn't like them rather than actually trying to remove them because they're a danger, the court said, we really don't want to be in the position of second guessing that type of a difficult situation, even if you have body cam footage. But in a case like Murphy versus Schmidt, for example, it's very different. The body cam footage is actually from, you know, 20 minutes later, when the police officer already took the critic into jail and he's talking to this other officer and they're considering what to charge the guy with, right? And then they're calling this other guy and talking to him about this. And it really shows many different things, not just that the officer dislikes the critic, but more like that the officer can't even come up with a crime because those kind of crimes don't happen very much, that he's actually looking for a pretextual crime. And that kind of body footage is very useful in these types of cases. And by the Eighth Circuit dismissed the body cam footage right out of the gate, said, we're not going to look at it. And by reversing that decision, I think the Supreme Court, again, is signaling that no, in those kinds of situations, body cam footage can be very useful. So body cam footage is not a panacea, but it can be used very effectively by people bringing civil rights cases to federal court.
Great. Someone asks, where do you foresee states moving to criminalize speech and what is being done to monitor and act?
Yes, this kind of a case could be these kind of series of decisions by the court could be very helpful in this area, because Villarreal is an example of essentially there being a statute on the books that criminalizes speech, right? The statute says you can't ask questions of government officials for the purposes of obtaining benefits. So that's an example of something that you're talking about. And the court basically said, even if you have that kind of a statute, first of all, you should challenge that statute. That statute is clearly unconstitutional. But even if you have that kind of statute and it hasn't yet been challenged, if it is used against a critic, that court should tread very carefully and consider all evidence that's before them before allowing that statute to be used as an excuse for throwing out a lawsuit.
Great. Another question is, taking photographs protected from criminalization as highly as speech?
Taking photographs, yes, if somebody is preventing you from taking photographs, it can be a violation of the First Amendment.
Great. Someone wants to know, this relates, but is a bit adjacent, but someone said, you mentioned qualified immunity, and they're wondering if that's different from the probable cause bar, and kind of what evidence defeats the qualified immunity.
Yeah, that's a great question. And that just goes to show you how difficult it is to litigate civil rights cases in the first place. But do not despair. Do not despair. I think actually the two questions are very much related. Qualified immunity, what it requires is that plaintiff finds a case that provides fair warning for a government official that what they're doing violates the Constitution. And the problem was that before the Supreme Court really started to weigh in on these issues, it was really hard for plaintiff to say, oh, it's clearly established, there is fair warning that if I am arrested and there is probable cause for my arrest, it can still violate my First Amendment rights. But the good news is that by issuing decisions like Gonzalez versus Trevino, now plaintiffs can make a twofold argument. Number one is that my case is not prevented from going forward merely because there's probable cause. But number two is that going forward, government officials are warned fairly notified that if they are putting somebody in jail, even when there is probable cause, that it can still be violation of the First Amendment. So I think decisions like Gonzalez, they help with the qualified immunity aspect of that as well. And you kind of can satisfy the requirement of both probable cause rule and the clearly established law test by pointing to cases like Gonzalez.
Great. Another question someone asks, if the Supreme Court case that is coming up this term, Barnes versus Felix, could change kind of views of body cams at all, if only a small amount can be used.
Yeah, it's hard to speculate, but obviously any kind of decision in this type of area could dramatically affect what happens going forward. So obviously the stakes in this kind of cases are very high. So I don't want to speculate, but I'm glad that you're keeping an eye on that one because it's definitely very important.
Great. So two people actually have questions about how unanimous each of these cases were and kind of what the breakdown is, if you remember that.
Yes, absolutely. So the summary reversals, they are unanimous. There is basically an order granting the petition, reversing the ruling, and remanding back to the lower court. And all it takes is four lines of text. And then it says, in light of Gonzalez versus Trevino. So it's clear that the court is saying, whatever we said in Gonzalez is affecting your case to the extent that we feel comfortable reversing whatever the lower court said. And now you have to start over. So those two summary reversals were unanimous, reaffirming Gonzalez. Gonzalez was an 8-1 per curiam decision. So per curiam means essentially there wasn't an author. It came from the entire court. And there was just one dissent. It was by Justice Thomas. And there were three separate concurrences by Justice Alito, Justice Jackson, whom Justice Sotomayor joined, and by Justice Kavanaugh. And those three concurring opinions kind of extrapolated more on what Gonzalez said by explaining that the only requirement on the evidence that plaintiff must allege is that evidence be objective. So Justice Jackson and Justice Alito helpfully explained more what that objectivity means. And according to them, objective means that it's beyond allegations of state of mind. Like I talked about, you can't just put in your complaint, the mayor looked at me funny, he did not like me. That's not going to get you this pretext that the courts are looking for. But if you can provide evidence that other people who are similarly situated, who are like Ms. Gonzalez criticizing the government and yet are not arrested for it, then that is very compelling. So the only justice who dissented from that ruling is Justice Thomas. And to Justice Thomas's credit, he's been very consistent on this. Every case involving First Amendment retaliation, he dissents on because he doesn't believe in the First Amendment retaliation cause of action in the first place. And I'm not going to get into the weeds, but it has a lot to do with the interpretation of under color of state law and how Monroe versus Pape said that under color of state law means that you don't just act pursuant to state statute. You can be a rogue government official and you can still be sued. First Amendment retaliation inherently has this rogue element because you have to be like subjectively with a bad state of mind going after somebody because you want to shut them up. So it's this rogue element of it that Justice Thomas is uncomfortable with because he doesn't think that rogue officials are covered under Section 1983. That Section 1983 is specifically for officers acting under color of law. So it's not that he disagrees with the analysis. He just doesn't think that those kinds of cases should be there in the first place. So that's the only dissenter. And I think that's partially why Gonzalez is a strong indication of this new, I wouldn't say new, but like a reformed attitude by the Supreme Court.
Helpful. So someone wonders if the state takes affirmative steps to help a private party by creating a kind of jurisdictional predicate for a lawsuit to start a civil lawsuit against other private parties. Is there a possible civil rights violation or ethics violation in any of that, even if no criminal charges or incarceration were involved?
Yeah, that sounds fishy.
Yeah.
Without knowing more, that sounds fishy. So that's something that's definitely worth looking into.
Great. And then Last question. This doesn't quite pertain to our topic, but I think they're interested because you work for Cato, you're involved with IJ, predictions about the obscenity case on the docket, FSC versus Paxton, and no worries if you don't want to speak to that right now.
Well, we filed an amicus brief in that case against the government, unsurprisingly. The fact that the case was granted, right, is already a strong signal that the court is leaning into the pro-free speech direction. So I'm hopeful that Texas loses on this. And again, it's very difficult to be making predictions, but just the fact that the case was granted is already, again, an indication of the Supreme Court being very interested in these types of cases.
Terrific. Well, Anya, thank you so much for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.